The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
When it comes to snacks, cashews are America and Europe's favourite nut, but they are costly and labour-intensive to produce. I'm Lucy Lamble, and in this Global Development podcast, I'll be asking, who's paying the real price for our love of products from the tropics? I travelled to southern India to follow the story of the cashew nut from tree to consumer. It's a complicated process that crosses continents. Over 60% of the cashews consumed globally are processed in India, which also grows over 500,000 tonnes itself. So just how important are cashews to the country's economy? Hari Krishnan Nair in Kolom is the chair of the Cashew Export Promotion Council of India.
It's grown, you know, all along the tropics, and India is the biggest producer. We have approximately 1 million people engaged directly in processing of cashews, and another 200,000 people odd who are engaged in the growing of cashews in the country. And if you also look at the people dependent on this, you're talking of a very, very large number of people.
Many of the nuts end up being sold in supermarkets for consumption in the EU, often having had value added in the West through roasting and salting. In 2007, ActionAid highlighted the pressure from UK supermarkets to drive down prices. The report revealed a rise in unofficial processing units, where margins are smaller and risks higher. Women were earning as little as 30 pence a day and suffering permanent damage to their hands from corrosive acids caused by handling the nuts. On paper, things have changed. A UK ombudsman has been appointed to work with supermarkets to ensure working conditions and food standards. She's due to take up her position at the end of 2013. But have conditions improved for workers? Cashew nuts are actually a seed that grows on a tree. I asked a factory owner in Panruti, in Tamil Nadu, to talk me through the production process after harvesting.
The nuts will be sun-dried for 4 days, 5 days, sun-dried. After that, it will be going to steaming. Then it go for shelling. Then it go for peeling. And then it will be processed. It takes around 21 days something, one nuts to have to process to eatable stay. It's a very big process.
How much does the cashew industry dominate this area?
Here, all over in Panruti area, all are depends upon the cashews only. All are depends. Even the small farmers, will be the small traders. The small trader, all farmer will do the process. Everyone will belongs to that cashews.
So, with the whole community invested in the production of cashews, I went back to the beginning of the story, where the nuts are grown. Baskir Baskar is a local farmer with 10 acres of land. He has paddy fields as well as cashew crops.
This year, because we didn't get good rain, the yield was not good.
Which of your crops is the most successful at the moment?
Cashew has given us a good profit compared to other things, because for other things, we have to incur a lot of expenditure. For the rest of the crops, we have to spend a lot compared to cashew. For cashew, we have to spend less.
It seems that for a range of farmers, cashew nuts are one of the few crops they can grow, if not the only option. Their profits are certainly not large, and they face increasing competition. Once the nuts are harvested, they're sent for processing. This happens in factories, but also at workers' homes. De-shelling the nuts is very labour-intensive and is done by hand. Sunita works in a government-run factory. She's been de-shelling nuts for 35 years and has seen some changes in working conditions.
She's working since 35 years in this sector, beating the shell and taking out that kernels before peeling. So they have a small wooden plank to sit on that. So sitting on the floor on that wooden plank, and there is an interval for a lunch break. So all the time keep on sitting in the same position. So they get the pain, but they can't leave the job, because as their all life is in that sector. They are forced to do the work. There is no other way.
From the factories I saw on my trip, I could see that food safety standards are widely understood. Workers usually wear hairnets, and there were safety inspection certificates on the walls. This is a prerequisite to be able to trade with supermarkets in Europe and the US. Here's the factory owner from Panruti again.
It is in the first stage. We are shelling the cashew nuts. There will be a liquid. It will be sometimes it will affect the human hands. That is the first stage, very difficult stage. You cannot get labor because no workers interested to do that work. Even many of the workers will go for grading and peeling like that. But the shelling is difficult.
During the de-shelling process, the nuts produce a caustic liquid which burns the skin. I saw that hand protection was available everywhere I went, but in some cases workers had to buy the rubber gloves on offer, and not everyone can afford them. So, factories are making an effort to protect workers, if they're on site, but some of the work is still being subcontracted to meet demand. I asked the factory owner in Panruti which process happens where.
It will go to that factory in that small house. They will process, they will do shelling, and they will give the kernels to us. After that, we will do all process like peeling and grading, all other factors. Because the cashew quality will be affected after peeling only. It's not before peeling, it can't be affected.
Lalita is a worker who peels cashews from home.
ഇത് വന്നിട്ട് അവർക്ക് കമ്പനിയിൽ കൊടുക്കുന്നതിനേക്കാളും ഫാക്ടറിയിൽ കൊടുക്കുന്നതിനേക്കാളും ഇത് അവർക്ക് ലാഭമാണ് എന്ന് വെച്ചാൽ ഫാക്ടറിയിലാണെങ്കിൽ ഒരു കിലോയ്ക്ക് 15 രൂപ
വർക്ക് ഇൻ ദി ഫാക്ടറീസ് ഡ്യൂ ടു ദി സ്മെൽ ഓഫ് ദിസ് സ്മോക്ക് ദിസ് കാർബൺ ഡയോക്സൈഡ് ആൻഡ് കാർബൺ മോണോക്സൈഡ് ഈസ് കമ്മിങ് ഫ്രം ദി ഷെൽസ് ആൻഡ് വൈൽ ദി ഷെൽസ് ആർ അഗെയിൻ ബേണിംഗ് കാർബൺ മോണോക്സൈഡ് ഈസ് കമ്മിങ് സോ ഷീ കനോട്ട് വർക്ക് ഇൻ ദി ഫാക്ടറീസ് സോ ഷീ ഇനിഷ്യലി ഇൻട്രസ്റ്റഡ് ടു വർക്ക് ഇൻ ദി ഹോം. Now she feels very bad because of the smell, heat of this process. She has to work sitting down in the floor and work, but she cannot continue it. Actually, she is getting half of the pay a woman in the factory gets. That's why main thing. If she gets full payment, she may continue. She is almost destitute. Husband is not taking care of her family. So she has to earn for her life and at the same time child. Just for the daily bread without any other alternative.
Whether they work at home or in the factory, labourers face a range of challenges for their health and livelihood. Either way, their pay is poor and their health can be at risk. But fundamentally, this is their only option for work. What are the more progressive companies doing to address these concerns?
The Indian rules are very strict, really, you know, in terms of a lot of facilities which have to be provided. And I think a lot of the companies do have a lot of the facilities which are required. But as in any country, there will be some companies which follow practices, you know, that are required to the letter of law and also what is behind it, and there will be companies which don't. I'm sure that it exists in the cashew sector, and as it does in other industries. In the sector today, it's difficult to get workers. So workers are preferring factories which offer better conditions. And because of that, I think most of the factories are trying to do new things to keep the workers which they have and also to attract new workers.
If it's so hard to attract workers to the industry, why are these labour standards falling short?
To a large extent, I think standards which I expect in the UK, it may be difficult to enforce those standards unless it is backed by the pricing which is required to make those standards work. On the food safety side, incidentally, I think India has recently passed legislation on called the Food Safety Standards Act, which is very, very strong. And a lot of companies are actually moving towards it. A lot of companies in the, I think nearly every company here is certified for food safety standards. So the cashews which you get are safe. I mean, you don't have any real horse meat type of issues on cashews. Cashews are the third biggest edible nut in the market today, after almonds and peanuts, walnuts, pecans. But these are the nuts. You know, if you look at pecans, they're grown in America. If you look at pistachios, they're grown mostly in America and a little bit in Iran. If you look at almonds, it's mostly grown in California and a little bit in Europe. And cashews, they're grown in countries which are among the poorest in the world. I mean, if you look at major growing countries of cashews. You have India as number one, number two is Guinea-Bissau, Benin, Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, Ghana, Vietnam, Brazil. I mean, these are all countries without the type of incomes which are there in the countries which grow the other nuts. So this is a crop grown by poor people, and it is actually sold as a premium product along with products which are made in rich countries. There's a big difference in the yield though. But cashews and almonds sell at the same price. So obviously if the farmer had a choice, he would grow almonds. But it's just that, you know, this is a tropical product and the other one is not a tropical product. And it's promoted better because it's grown in California and also, you know, countries which have the savvy to promote their product. When it's sold at the same price as almonds, I mean, it's not something which customers know. At the same time, remember that, you know, there are a lot of people living off this, and if you eat more cashews, there's poor people who make an income from it.
Hari Krishnan there, speaking in Koilam. So what should be done to make the supply chain more fair but still viable? Where should changes be made? And should consumers around the world still buy cashews? Joining me in the studio are Fiona Gooch, Senior Policy Advisor at Tradecraft, and Felicity Lawrence, Guardian investigative reporter and author of a new book on the global food industry, Not on the Label. Sadly, none of the leading UK supermarkets were able to put forward a representative, but we do have a statement from Intersnack, the largest EU packer of cashews. Fiona, you've spoken to both business owners in India and traders in Europe. Where do you see the biggest problems?
One of the key issues that we are highly concerned about is the application of unfair or abusive trading practices within supply chains. In general, they're applied by supermarkets, but the impacts are really harshly felt by workers and farmers throughout the supply chains that supply Europe with food. And so this is an issue we feel very strongly needs to be addressed. And the result is low pay, really poor health and safety conditions, especially in cashews, particularly with this caustic or acidic oil that literally burns people's hands. So these are the issues we're very concerned about, but they are driven by these unfair trading practices.
And why do these problems persist with labour standards and the buying practices?
What we've got at the moment is that power is moving to supermarkets in general terms, and supermarkets capitalise on that because essentially if you are selling a product to the European market, unless you get it into a supermarket, your product doesn't find the market because supermarkets gatekeep the market. So supermarkets abuse their power and force suppliers to pay for things that are not appropriate. They don't necessarily pay suppliers the amount that they promised or the correct amount. This results in suppliers passing that squeeze back up the supply chain towards other suppliers and results very crucially in poor working conditions on workers and farmers. And from the Indian cashew processor point of view, when 80% of their processing cost is linked to workers, that's either pay or social security, when they are being squeezed on price, they look to reduce that component of the processing cost. And that has led to really vile working conditions, but also a systematic approach of subcontracting the labour-intensive stages of processing, which means deshelling, where workers hold these acidic raw nuts in their hands and then have to break them open to extract the cashew nut that we eat.
Felicity, why is it that processors can manage to deliver on food safety and quality and yet get away without addressing these labour concerns?
Well, I think it's because the people who are buying from them don't give enough priority to the labour concerns. Fiona's absolutely right. What's happened is this extraordinary concentration of power in retailing so that the access to consumers is controlled through a handful of global supermarket groups. But there's also, partly because of that, an extraordinary concentration in processing itself, partly to stand up to the power of supermarket buying. In most tropical commodity sectors, you see just a handful of players who control the whole market. There's nowhere else to go. And if they aren't put under pressure to improve labour standards, they won't. But also, if they are being squeezed on costs, they actually have very little control over a lot of their costs. You know, transport, logistics and basic raw materials, a lot of those things are going up. The price of oil is going up, the price of commodities is going up generally if you look at grains or whatever, partly because of climate change and global population growth. So what's left that they've got some kind of control over is labour, and that's where the squeeze comes. But I think the other thing we're seeing, and I'm moving away slightly now from cashews to sort of other sectors, maybe sort of the sort of broader grain, cocoa, milk, so on. You're seeing huge inflationary pressure in the price of the goods themselves, partly because of the price of oil, increased demand. But the big corporate players who have captured those markets are sloughing off their responsibilities for employment, whereas in the past, quite recent past, you would have seen them directly employing large numbers of people. They're now increasingly outsourcing, they're allowing management buyouts, and they're putting themselves further and further away from responsibility and accountability for the labour part of the chain. So they're often not even producing directly anymore.
So Fiona, in India, conditions did seem to be worse at subcontractor level. Why is that?
Essentially, the subcontractors are asked to provide packers with kernels. And the reason the subcontractors are used is because the labour-intensive stages of cashew processing, which is deshelling where this very nasty caustic oil comes out of the raw nut as people handle the nuts in their hands, and then the peeling stage is extremely labour intensive. And because that is the highest component of a processor's cost, the subcontractors essentially are asked to do that work for a lower price than presumably the packer is able to fund for those stages. And so Tradecraft saw on a recent trip to India, not only are subcontractors being used, but also home workers are deshelling cashew nuts that then go back to a small processor. And then that might go to a well-established packer who puts these cashew nuts that may have been processed elsewhere into this vacu-pack flexible packaging, which is then sent off to Europe as though the cashew nuts had actually been processed at their facility, when that's very much not the case.
So can labour conditions be improved by northern supermarkets insisting on standards in the same way they do with food safety? How would that actually work in practice? It's presumably easier for them to test for hygiene and quality at, say, a UK port than it would be for the labour standards. Who would do the inspecting?
I think a more rounded approach is needed. At the moment, what retailers are doing are asking for audits, which they use as a paper fig leaf should anyone else turn up and ask them about working conditions. If you are serious about working conditions and you are the buyer and therefore able to exert a lot of influence over suppliers, you would have a very serious conversation with your supplier saying, I am seriously interested in good working conditions. You would facilitate a conversation perhaps with local government and local civil society who actually know what workers need, and you would get stuck in to making improvements work in a way that met workers' priorities, and you would accept the responsibility that falls on your shoulders as a supermarket, which particularly refers to the commercial aspects of how you buy. Whereas at the moment, what we have is supermarkets demanding good working conditions, but doing nothing in the way that they buy on a commercial basis to actually enable that. In fact, they are undermining it. The constant pressure on price, not paying suppliers correctly, making retrospective changes, asking for ad hoc, for want of a better word, donations, systematically drives these unacceptable and appalling working conditions, despite the fact that, in theory, they have a labour standards code.
The UK has appointed its first ever supermarket ombudsman, Christine Tacon, to consider anonymised complaints from suppliers. Earlier, I spoke to Sir Jim Pace, Conservative MP for South East Cambridgeshire, who was UK Minister of State for Agriculture and Food between 2010 and 2012. And I asked him what he sees as the key features of the role of the adjudicator.
Well, basically, it was to implement the proposal of the Competition Commission. The Competition Commission concluded that some of the buying practices, the relationships between supermarkets and their suppliers, were such that the burden of the risk of it was too heavily weighted towards the suppliers. Supermarkets themselves were taking insufficient risk, that balance of risk therefore could ultimately lead to the disadvantage of the consumer, And that was why they proposed a code of practice, which was introduced in, I think, early 2010. The statutory code of practice to be enforced by an adjudicator, or as that was then called, an ombudsman. So the role of the adjudicator, as it's now called, is purely to enforce that code of practice on the biggest of our retailers.
And what measures do you think the EU should be taking to promote best practices in foreign labour, ones that they're not currently doing?
Well, I'm afraid I'm not over keen on statutory intervention in this. I really do think this is something for consumers to use their own power and for retailers to respond to. And we're already seeing, we've seen in the last few months, a number of major retailers realise that the way they have been practising their supply chains in the past has not been acceptable, and that, I mean, you've only got to look at what happened to Nike with the supply of sports equipment being made with using child labour. They suddenly realised that had to stop because it was unacceptable and because their customers didn't like it. And we're now seeing that beginning to happen in other parts of the food supply chain. Indeed, fair trade, of course, is that in itself is partly derived from it. So I think we're already seeing most of the retailers beginning to adopt a much more responsible approach to the whole of their supply chain in that way. What role there can be for statutory intervention, bearing in mind we're talking about third countries where neither the EU writ nor the British writ runs, is very difficult to see how it could actually be designed and enforced.
Some major UK supermarkets like Aldi, Lidl and Tesco are actually coordinating their sourcing strategies across their EU operations. Is there a need, therefore, for a coordinated enforcement of foreign worker standards between the EU and the UK's new groceries code adjudicator?
At the moment, foreign worker standards are not enforceable, as far as I know, anywhere in the EU, certainly not in the UK, in terms of statutory enforceable. And certainly the adjudicator is not involved in anything to do that. I mean, the adjudicator doesn't even have any role as far as the UK labour force is concerned. The adjudicator's role is purely on the terms of trade between a supplier and a retailer, and nothing more than that. So to move into labour conditions would be a very radical shift, and frankly, it's not what the adjudicator was set up for. But as I say, I think, and you've just touched on it yourself, if you've got supermarkets now beginning to coordinate their activities across the whole of the EU, then you've got supermarkets already beginning to recognise their own social responsibility to have a more, frankly, more moral approach to the way they obtain their supplies.
Felicity, Sir Jim Pace suggested that consumer pressure is ultimately enough to enforce worker standards. Is that realistic?
No, I think it's an utter cop-out for a politician to say, over to you, consumers. You know, whatever your income, however hard you're finding it out there, it's up to you. And if you buy the sort of more expensive version that's got some decent labour standards attached, you make that choice. But if you don't, fine, buy this cheaper one and to hell with the labour standards. I mean, that's just a ridiculous position to be in. Some people can't afford to take their moral shopping. The responsibility for it lies elsewhere in the chain. It should be absolutely clear that whatever you buy in the shops, you don't have to be defensive in your shopping. You can know that you're buying it in the knowledge that the proper care has been taken of workers in the chain.
Fiona?
I think the idea that consumers can exercise power on retailers is naive. You would probably need about more than 2 million consumers acting and communicating in exactly the same way, to have the same countervailing power on a supermarket as the supermarket has on the suppliers. That's kind of how the power dynamics are working in the supply chain at the moment. But consumers certainly do not have that level of power on top of the retailers, which is why power is concentrating at a retail level. In fact, the power dynamic is entirely the opposite. Retailers choice edit and manipulate consumers. They put on the shelf the product that makes them the most profit. And we have come across as Tradecraft talking with our European partners that several countries are now finding that certain products are no longer available on the shelf because a different product is put on the shelf, which presumably is the one that makes more money. And consumers are starting to get slightly up in arms about this in other European countries.
Does Christine Tacon actually have sufficient powers? How relevant is a UK role in such an integrated EU market?
Fair dealing is defined as ensuring that suppliers can have certainty. And that's the one thing suppliers do not have at the moment because of this continuous application of unfair and abusive trading practices. And I suppose one of the things I choose to keep in mind is that the Competition Commission said that retailers systematically applied excessive risk and unexpected costs onto their suppliers. So that is ultimately what we are aiming to cease. And if that stops, we genuinely will have good operating supply chains that work for consumers and suppliers and a market that actually functions. We don't have that at the moment.
So in Kerala, for example, it's a relatively unionised part of India with a commitment to workers' rights. To what extent is there a danger that factory owners simply move their operations to less stringent states or bring in migrant labour to get around the issues?
Both of what you said might happen is happening. So Tradecraft witnessed that there is an awful lot of subcontracting from Kerala to Tamil Nadu where the labour standards are cheaper. Tradecraft also saw migrant labour being used, and we heard the very unfortunate words that these migrant workers were so compliant and wanted to work all hours of the day. Now, if workers are paid an adequate piece rate wage for a normal number of working hours, this wouldn't drive extremely long hours to make ends meet.
It must be tempting for newer operators simply to mechanise as a way of avoiding all these labour problems. What's the impact on jobs?
Well, the interesting thing is a lot of these processes do actually need real people with real skills. This phenomenon of migrant labour, I think people in Europe tend to think of, you know, that with a sort of fortress mentality that all these migrant workers are wanting to come here, and particularly those on the right, and they don't make that connection on the right with the fact that actually exploitative wages drive migration. They do still need real people. And I think one of the things that's encouraging to me, because a lot of this is very dispiriting and feels as though we're going backwards to the dark ages pre-Factory Act and so on, but I am hearing from some retailers that they realise that their best protection in terms of the quality of their produce and productivity is to actually have a better employed workforce. You are less likely to get the types of food frauds we're being exposed to if the workers in the factory are valued, are paid properly and are consistent. They're more likely to speak up, and that it's actually in the retailer's long-term interests. That's not true of all retailers, but the more enlightened ones it is, and even the less enlightened ones privately will say to you, actually they'd really like more enforcement because they don't want to be competing on the ground that they are currently competing on.
We do not believe that supermarkets voluntarily are able to stop doing a practice that is so profitable. And unfortunately, that means that our public authorities need to step up to the mark. And so we, as Tradecraft, are calling upon Commissioner Barnier, who has a responsibility for the internal market of Europe, to enforce and to develop an enforcement mechanism that actually will dissuade supermarkets from applying these extremely profitable practices. And the reason it's necessary is because the European public authorities need to catch up with reality. Supermarkets are not buying for their national markets anymore. They are doing something called group sourcing. That means that it is likely, or in fact we know, that one supermarket that may have shops in many different European countries is doing the sourcing in one point. That means that that particular purchaser for that particular retailer has enormous amounts of power, more than just buying for one country. And the European Union, and particularly Commissioner Barnier, needs to stop these happening. And if any of your listeners are minded to act, we would really very much welcome them coming to Tradecraft's website and taking an action to call on Commissioner Barnier to set up a credible, tough, independent enforcement mechanism to stop these unfair trading practices.
So according to Intersnack, in a statement they gave us earlier, they said the following: "We believe that the industry participants itself should be the catalyst for change without the need for legislation to that effect. Each individual company should make its own choices, whether this is supported or not by retail, consumers or governments." Intersnack went on to say, "Similarly, if legislation came in, it would be a simplification to say that this would solve everything. Food safety legislation did raise overall standards, but it did not prevent mishaps from taking place. Again, here one sees that the standards of the individual operator or participant in the chain are the biggest driver. legislation would, in our opinion, focus too much on certification, which is very expensive and does not guarantee that those certified have proper practices, just as a driving licence doesn't guarantee that the holder is an adequate driver. They go on to say, similarly, when legislation would come into place, the suggestion is that all will be solved, but this is a simplification. Food safety legislation did raise overall standards, but did not prevent mishaps from taking place. Felicity.
Well, business is always opposed to more legislation. The sort of trend at the moment is to talk about legislation as a burden on business and red tape and stuff that you should get rid of. I think, you know, scandals like the horse meat scandal here show just what happens when you deregulate so far. And business reacts to regulation, and actually it creates a level playing field. So where businesses have taken the initiative and market themselves as caring about these things, including labour standards, it's fair if everybody else has to follow those. Some businesses would welcome legislation, and I think it's those who aren't prepared to actually do the decent thing who argue against it.
The horse meat scandal is a symptom of the relentless pressure that suppliers to supermarkets are under. It is a logical but unfortunate outcome of such pressure. And in relation to poor working conditions in the cashew nut sector, several processors told us that retailers are placing orders and buying cashews at a price that is below cost price, but they ask no questions. They are not interested in what is presumably the logical outcome of purchasing at below cost price.
So finally, given what we know about the challenges and the conditions, should consumers around the world still be buying cashews? Felicity.
Well, I'm always very reluctant to say boycott something because obviously the workers still depend on the jobs. So I try to buy fair trade where I can. I don't think that's the whole answer. What we need as Tradecraft is very quick to acknowledge and fight for is a change, a legislative change, and a change in the balance of power. And what you buy in the shops, you can't do it on your own. You do need governments to act. But what you can do is send messages with your buying habits. But I hesitate even to say that because I think what the situation we're in at the moment is all the responsibility is being pushed back on the consumers to act ethically. Some people may be able to afford that, some people may be less able to afford that, and it shouldn't really be about you making those choices in the shops. It should be about the people who are actually making profits out of this behaving ethically and responsibly, and that should be part of the legal requirement.
That's all we've got time for in this month's Global Development Podcast. My thanks go to Fiona Gooch and Felicity Lawrence. And for more on this issue, go to theguardian.com/global-development.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code GUARDIAN.